The air grew warm. The sweet cider taste of the champagne was in his mouth, mingled with his mother's perfume. And he knew, even then, that the sensation would be with him for the rest of his life. When the song stopped, his mother whispered, "Happy New Year." His father had been leaning against the kitchen doorway. When the orchestra started in again, he walked up and said, "Pardon me, may I cut in?" His mother slipped away from Edgar and into his father's arms. Edgar watched them dance, music ringing through the house. And then he opened the refrigerator and took a package of curds and pulled on his shoes and coat. He tried to tell them where he was going. Though the song had ended, they stood there, swaying, silhouetted against the lights of the Christmas tree. He and Amandine ran through a night black and sharp-edged with cold. In the barn, he switched on the lights and set Patty Page singing the Tennessee Waltz on the old record player. Then he used up the curds, handing them out to the dogs, even the puppies, and signing to each in turn a Happy New Year. January thaw. The ash they spread along the driveway melted the snow into gray puddles, candied with ice in the morning. He sat in their living room wearing a coat and boots, watching for the yellow caterpillar of the school bus through the bare trees. In the afternoons, the sun was up barely long enough to take his litter into the yard before supper time to proof them on comfors and stays in the snow. They learned quickly now. He led three of them at a time to the birches in the south field, then ran to the yard and released them with a sweeping gesture they could see against the sky. And they sliced across the field like a trio of wolves, bodies stretched over the white snowdrifts. He was getting better, too. With a single dog, he could make leash corrections as well as his mother, catching them in the middle of their first step out of stay, when they had barely made up their mind to break. When he did it right, they settled back before lifting their hindquarters all the way off the ground. But he didn't make it look easy like she did. It took every bit of his concentration. He learned to toss a collar chain at their hindquarters if they didn't come on the long line recalls, though his accuracy was a problem. Plus, he moved his arm so much they saw it coming. He practiced against a bale of straw. His mother could flick her wrist and catch a dog loafing halfway across the mow. When he wasn't expecting it, she threw one against his own backside. The shock of it, the jingle, and the impact made him jump. "Like that," she said, smiling. "Works pretty well, doesn't it?" And all the while his dogs grew smarter, caught on to the corrections and found ways to beat them. They would be 7 months old soon, and their coats were sleek and winter-thickened. They'd grown as tall as they were going to get, but his father said their chests wouldn't fill out until the summer. Dr. Papineau, when he visited, could never keep them straight, but to Edgar they were so different it was hard to believe they came from the same litter. He could tell them apart by their movements alone, the sound of their footfalls. Essay always pushed to see what she could get away with, waiting until he looked away to bolt. Tinder, the most rambunctious, would break a stay just because one of his littermates looked at him with a certain glint in his eye. Babu was the opposite. Once in a stay, he would sit forever. He made up for his delay coming off the long line with his love of retrieves. He trotted back to Edgar again and again with the target in his mouth, an aw-shuck swagger rocking his hindquarters. They were, each of them, brilliant, frustrating, stubborn, petulant. And Edgar could watch them move, just move, all day. Icy grains, dry and white, were falling from low flanneled clouds. The wind gathered and swept the grains across the yard like a surf. When Edgar opened the barn door, a tendril of snow scorpioned along the cement floor and dispersed at Almandine's feet. His father was kneeling in the farthest whelping pen, where a pup squirmed and mewled on the silver pan of the scale, its ears folded and otter-like. As Edgar watched, his father cradled the pup in his hands and set it back with its mother. Giants, he said, writing a note on the log sheet. And ornery. They haven't opened their eyes yet, and they're already pushing each other around. You should be grateful you didn't end up with this batch.
I'm taking mine upstairs, Edgar signed.
His father nodded and turned back to the pup. I want to clean out those buckets in the workshop before your mother gets back from town. When you finish, find me, okay?
Okay,
he signed. He knew which buckets his father meant, a whole row of them under the workshop stairs, all different sizes. Some not buckets at all, but battered old, lidless 10-gallon milk cans filled to the brim with scrap metal, old nails, hinges, screws, bolts. His father had been threatening to either sort through them or pitch them into the silo for as long as he could remember. Edgar pulled Finch and Essay out of their runs to practice long-distance downs. The dogs bounded to the workshop and up the stairs, tussling and growling in the straw as he and Almandine followed. In the mow, he could see his breath in the air. He closed the vestibule door. Almandine, without immediate training duties, found a comfortable corner to watch from. Edgar stayed one dog and let it rest while he snapped a long line to the other's collar and put it in a standing stay. On each trial, he lifted his hand overhead to signal a down, rewarding them with a scrub of their ruff, or correcting with a sharp tug on the long line, which he'd threaded through an eye bolt in the floor to direct the force down and not forward. As soon as they'd mastered one distance, he retreated a pace farther. Essay understood the exercise at once and how to confound it. She waited until Edgar was walking toward her, when it was hardest to give a correction, then stood up before she was released, panting merrily. Or she would lie down, but immediately roll over. Twice, when she was supposed to be waiting her turn, he discovered her poking at the bales of straw, contemplating a climb. Finch, on the other hand, never took his eyes off Edgar. The problem was he just kept standing there, watching when Edgar signed the down. After Edgar had repeated the command three times, Finch began to look concerned. Edgar scolded himself for repeating commands and walked over, but the sight of Edgar approaching struck Finch like a bolt of inspiration, and the dog slid to the floor. For a break, Edgar flung tennis balls and whirled coffee can lids into the farthest corners of the mow for the dogs to chase. The pounding of their feet on the mow floor provoked the kennel dogs below into a chorus of muffled barks. He'd started the two of them holding retrieval targets, just taking them in their mouths for a second or two, when he noticed that the kennel dogs were still barking. Odd, since both his dogs were now sitting quietly. Edgar opened the vestibule door and listened, then started down the stairs. Finch and Essay, nails clicking on the wooden treads, crowded past him. Got to work on that, he thought. He was almost to the bottom tread before he saw his father, sprawled and motionless on the floor near the workshop entrance. He was wearing his winter coat, as if heading outside, and he lay face down. For a moment, Edgar stood paralyzed. Then he bolted down the steps and was on his knees beside his father, while Essay and Finch stomped and plunged around them. He shook his father, and dug his fingers into the heavy fabric of his coat, and rolled him onto his back and peered into his face. What happened? What happened? Behind the lenses of his glasses, his father blinked. How slowly his eyes tracked Edgar's hands. He strained to lift his head, raising it no more than an inch off the floor. He stopped and took a breath. Edgar slipped his hand beneath his father's head before it could fall back against the cement. And then he was frantic. He withdrew his hand as gently as he could and checked his fingers for blood, but there was none. He tore his sweater off and bunched it up beneath his father's head. His father's mouth had fallen open. "Can you see me?" he signed. He yanked down the zipper of his father's coat and looked at the checkered work shirt beneath. He patted him from throat to belt. No blood, no injury. What happened?
Did you fall? Can you see me?
His father didn't answer, nor was he looking back. Then Edgar was running through the cold, the house jerking in his vision. Wisps of snow coiled around the porch steps. He burst into the kitchen and yanked the phone off its hook. He stood for a moment, unsure of what to do. He pulled the zero around on the dial and waited. Almandine was in the kitchen with him. He couldn't remember her running alongside to the house, or even following him down from the mow. After the second ring, a woman's voice came on the line. "Operator." He was already trying to make the words. He moved his lips. A sigh came out of him, thin and dry.
"This is the operator. How may I help you?"
His heart surged in his chest. He tried to force sound from his mouth, but there was only the gasp of exhaled breath. He swung his hand wide, then struck his chest with all the force he could muster, mouthing the words.
"Is this an emergency?"
the operator said. He struck his chest again, again. Each blow drove a single note from his body.
"Can you tell me where you are?"
the operator said. Almandine retreated a step and began a deep, throaty barking, smashing her tail from side to side and chasing toward the door and back.
"I can't understand you. Can you tell me where you are?"
He stood panting. He beat the receiver against the countertop until it was in fragments, and left it hanging, and ran out the door and up the driveway and onto the road, hoping to see his mother arriving in their truck, or a car passing, any car. Almandine was beside him now. The woods were lost in the falling snow, the apple trees blanched. Beyond 100 yards, everything faded into a featureless blank, so white it hurt to stare into it. A car would not be passing in such a storm. When he looked back at the barn, Esse and Finch were crossing the yard toward them. The four of them stood while he looked up and back along the road. Then he ran to the house again. A voice was coming out of the shattered handset.
"Need you to stay where you are. I am..."
The dogs pranced in his path as he crossed to the barn. He'd left the door open, and all the time cold air had been pouring in. He flung the door shut and threw the latch and knelt beside his father.
"Are you okay? Are you okay? Are you okay?"
His father wouldn't look at him. Wouldn't look at him. He ran to the medicine room at the back of the barn and tore his hands across the shelves. Gauze and pills scattered around his feet as he pawed through the supplies. He returned empty-handed.
"Just keep him warm," he thought.
He pulled his spare coat off the hook inside the workshop and draped it across his father's chest. A rack of shivers came over Edgar. Almandine walked up and put her nose to his father's cheek. Her hind legs shook as if scenting something fearful and strange. The sight made Edgar angry, and he got his legs beneath him and flew at her. She bolted to the far end of the barn and watched as he staggered back to the workshop. He knelt and looked into his father's face. He pressed his hands against his chest. He thought he would feel breath being drawn, but instead there was a single long exhalation. Through his father's open mouth came a groan, expressionless and mechanical, in a falling note. After that, nothing at all. No movement. No insuck of breath. No twitch of an eyelid. Just that collapse, like a wax figure melting. He ran down the line of pens, beating on the wire. The dogs stood on their hind legs and wailed and bayed, the roar of them like an anthem. Yet through it all, he heard the whisper of snow seeping beneath the doors, seething along the floor toward his father lying there on the concrete, motionless, looking nowhere and breathing nothing. The floor jolted as if something had struck the earth. Edgar realized he was sitting. He pulled himself upright, square by square, along the wire of a pen door. Then he was beside his father again, and the dogs were quiet. Almandine crept over and nosed his hand and sat beside him.
The other stayed hidden at the far end of the kennel, panting and watching. And so they waited. Storm. When he closed his eyes, something horrid bloomed there. A black-petaled shape boiling endlessly outward. In his body he stayed beside his father, but in his mind he stood and walked through the barn door. Outside it was a summer evening. The sun set, the earth dark. He crossed the yard and entered the house, and inside he lifted an undamaged telephone receiver and spoke. No one replied. He was outside again. A windless rain began to fall, carrying down the night. He walked along the road, clothes drenched and hanging, and all was quiet, and he walked that way for hours. He heard a sound, the muffled crunch of tires on the icy driveway. The dogs began to bark. Some threw themselves at the closed drop gates to their outer runs. A man's voice shouting, the porch door slamming. The sounds drew him back until he was sitting beside his father once more. He tried to stand, but failed. At the last minute, he threw his weight to the side and scrambled along the barn floor in order not to touch his father. He lay panting. Almondine came from somewhere near the file cabinets and nosed his hand until he forced himself up. He went to the barn doors and threw them open. Blue snow. Shadows bluer yet. He was almost at the house when Dr. Papineau appeared at the back porch door.
"Edgar, your door was swinging wide," he began and then stopped. His gaze moved to the barn. "What's going on?" he said. "Where are your folks?"
All Edgar could do was stand before the old man, trembling. His teeth chattered, and the muscles in his face began jerking, all out of control. Then one of his legs buckled, and he sank into the snow, and the last thing he saw was Dr. Papineau rushing forward. He woke in his parents' bedroom. He was lying on his side, facing the doorway, Almondine beside him. Dr. Papineau was leaning heavily against the kitchen cabinets, his back to Edgar, talking on the battered phone.
"Yes," he was saying. "Of course. For God's sake, Glenn, Gar Sartell's lying out there in his barn, and his son is in some sort of shock."
"No. No.
I don't know. His hands are bruised and cut up."
"All right. Okay. Yes, that must have been him. It was busted to pieces and hanging off the hook when I got here. I'm surprised it even works." There was a pause.
"The feed mill," he said. "Maybe the grocery store. If she's not on the way back already. Try to get a hold of her before... She has the truck. It's a brown... Chevy with a topper."
"Uh-huh. Uh-huh." Then he said, "No." The word had an air of finality to it. When he hung up the phone, he ran his hands through his white hair and heaved himself upright and turned and walked to the bedroom.
"Son," he said. "Edgar."
Edgar looked at him and tried to sit up. The old man put a hand on his shoulder.
"Just lie back," he said. "Do you know what's happening here?"
"I shouldn't have left him. He won't stay warm out there."
"Edgar, I can't understand when you sign." Dr. Papineau stood and turned back to the kitchen. "I'll get you a pencil and paper."
As soon as he was out of the room, Edgar was up, running through the kitchen. But his sense of balance had gone awry. He crashed into the table and fell. By the time he got up and opened the porch door, Dr. Papineau had him by the arm. For a moment he hung suspended in mid-stride above the back steps. Then Dr. Papineau couldn't hold on, and Edgar fell into the snow just beyond the stoop. Before he could move, Dr. Papineau was on top of him.
"Hold on," he said. "I don't want you going out there. There's nothing you can do right now, and seeing him like that is going to make it worse later. Come inside and wait with me, okay?"
For an old man, Dr. Papineau was surprisingly strong. He lifted Edgar out of the snow by the back of his shirt. Edgar felt the buttons in front straining to pop as he got his feet beneath him.
"Can you walk okay?"
He nodded. The snow where he had fallen was stained red from the cuts and gashes on his hands. They walked into the house, Papineau's hand firmly on Edgar's shoulder. Edgar sat at the table and looked at the veterinarian, until the old man looked away, then stood and began to make coffee. Edgar walked to the corner of the kitchen and sat on the floor, near the heat vent, letting the air blow across his feet. He clapped for Almondine. She came and stood beside him and breathed and leaned against him. The cuts on his hands stung as if they had burst into flame.
"There's coffee," Dr. Papineau said after a while.
When he didn't answer, Dr. Papineau took a cup from the cupboard and filled it and sat back down at the table. He looked at the phone and the clock and the boy.
"I'm sorry about all this, Edgar," he said at last. "But one thing I've learned from all these years of veterinary has been to attend to the living. Your dad's out there, and I'm sorry there's nothing we can do for him. But it isn't going to do anyone any good for you to go out there and drive yourself crazy. I know that's hard, but in time you'll see it's true. Everyone loses people, you understand? It's terrible. It's a tragedy for a boy like you to have to deal with this, but there's nothing you or I or anyone else can do now but wait until people get here who know how to handle this."
Dr. Papineau's voice was calm, but his thumb was twitching and thumping on the table, and he'd put one hand over the other to steady it. Edgar closed his eyes and let the black-petaled thing twist before him. After a while, he was walking along the dark road again, and the rain was falling. And the longer he walked, the narrower and more overgrown the road became, until at last it was almost a comfort. When Almondine lifted her head, he heard the siren, faint at first, then louder as it topped the hill. He looked at his hands. There were windings of white gauze around each palm, neatly secured with medical tape. Dr. Papineau must have dressed them with bandages, but he didn't recall it. He walked into the living room and found the veterinarian standing at the window. They watched the ambulance pull into the driveway and then the truck. Edgar's mother sat on the passenger side. She turned to look through the window as the truck passed the house, her face blank with shock. Edgar walked to the kitchen and sat by the register again. Dr. Papineau opened the kitchen door and went outside. Edgar heard men's voices. In a few moments, his mother knelt beside him.
"Look at me,"
she said hoarsely. He turned but couldn't meet her gaze for long.
"Edgar," she said, "how long were you out there?"
When he didn't answer, she said,
"The operator got a call around 2 o'clock, but no one spoke. That was you?"
He nodded. He watched her face to see if she'd already guessed how much he was to blame, but she only bent her head to touch his and wrapped her arms around his shoulders. At her touch, a flame rose in him and ate him alive, and when it was gone, he was left sitting, hollowed out in her arms.
"I know what you're thinking, Edgar," she whispered. "Look at me. This wasn't because of you. I don't know what happened, but you're going to have to tell me, no matter how bad it was. Do you understand? I'll wait all night if you need me to, and we'll just sit together, but before we go to sleep, you have to tell me what happened."
It wasn't until she pulled his head up that he realized he had crossed his arms over his head. Her hands were warm against his face. He wanted to tell her everything right then, and he wanted to say nothing, ever. He lifted his hands to sign, then realized he didn't know what he wanted to say. He tried again.
"It won't be true if I don't say it."
She looked down at his bandaged hands and took them into hers.
"But you know that's wrong, don't you? There's nothing we can do to bring him back."
Her face crumpled and she started to cry. He put his arms around her and squeezed. Then a man appeared in the doorway, an enormous, broad man, a giant, youthful projection of Dr. Papineau. Glenn Papineau, the Mellon sheriff. Edgar's mother stood. Glenn put his hand on her arm and guided her to the table and pulled out a chair.
"Why don't you sit down?" he said.
Glenn Papineau pulled out a chair and sat too, his parka rustling as he moved, the chair creaking under his weight.
"From the way things look out there, he was carrying something heavy, a bucket of scrap metal, when it happened," Glenn said. "It's possible he had a stroke, Trudy."
There was a long silence.
"Is there somebody I can call for you?"
Before she could answer, Dr. Papineau spoke up.
"I'm going to spend the night here, Glenn. If there's someone to call, I'll do it."
The sheriff looked from his father's earnest, elderly face to Trudy, who nodded absently.
"I'm going to need to talk with your son eventually for my report, Trudy. I know this isn't the best time, but it has to be soon. Now would be best."
"No," she said, "not today."
"Okay, tomorrow at the latest. I guess I'll need you, too. He only signs, is that right?"
"Of course. You know that, Glenn."
"I just mean, if you don't feel up to it, I could see if we could arrange an interpreter," Glenn said.
He sounded taken aback at his mother's tone, which was a mixture of weariness and pain and impatience.
"It has to be me."
"Why's that?"
"What Edgar signs is sort of half his own invention. Gar and I can read it. Could. Can. A conventional signer wouldn't make much sense of it. He could write things out, or we can bring in his old letter board, but that would take a long time. Besides, I wouldn't let you question my son without being there."
"All right, all right," Glenn said. "I just thought it might make things easier on you. When you feel up to it in the morning, call the office."
He turned and stepped onto the porch. Dr. Papineau followed him out of the house. They talked outside on the stoop, voices low. Suddenly Edgar's mother stood up and strode to the door.
"God damn it, Glenn!"
she shouted, her voice so loud Edgar could hear an echo off the side of the barn.
"If something needs taking care of, you talk to me. Me, do you understand? Paige, thank you for being here, but I won't have you and your son making decisions for us. This is our place. Glenn, you'll talk to me."
"Trudy," said Glenn, I guess I was just telling Dad here that I asked John and Al to take Gar to Brenston's, and that you or he, somebody, should call and talk to Bert about the arrangements. If you want someone else to handle things, he'll help get that squared away. That's all. We weren't trying to hide anything from you. We were trying to ease things up on you."
"I know you're doing what seems right, but I'm not helpless. I don't expect this to be easy, and I don't expect I'll have to go through it alone, but I do expect that whatever decisions have to be made will be made by me and no one else. Understood? When I need help, I'll ask for it. Brenston's, by the way, will be fine, Glenn. If you could let Mr. Brenston know, I'll call him in the morning. I would appreciate that. I'll call you in the morning, too. Now, Paige, come inside before you catch pneumonia."
There was silence, and then the three of them exchanged brief goodbyes. Dr. Papineau came inside, and Edgar's mother walked into the living room and watched the ambulance and the squad car maneuver up the driveway and onto the snow-packed hill toward Mellon. After the taillights had disappeared, Trudy walked into the kitchen.
"Paige, would you mind making some dinner? Anything you'd like. We need to go out to the kennel and..."
"Hold it a second," Dr. Papineau said gently.
"Are you sure you wouldn't rather I took on the chores? That way you and Edgar could spend some time talking."
"No, we need dinner, and that's much too quiet a thing for either of us to be doing. Edgar's going to come out to the barn, and when we come back, the best thing in the world would be if dinner was ready, assuming we can find any appetite."
She turned to Edgar.
"Edgar, can you come out to the kennel and help with chores?"
Though the idea of going into the barn made him dizzy, Edgar stood. His coat lay on the bedroom floor. By the time they walked out the door, Almandine at their side, Dr. Papineau had taken a white package of butcher-wrapped meat from the refrigerator and was standing and looking into the cupboards. Outside, Trudy stopped and took Edgar by the shoulders and wrapped her arms around him. She whispered in his ear, "Edgar, if we want to keep this place, we have to look like we can do it right from the start. I don't know if I should ask you to do this, but I'm going to anyway. Listen to me, honey. Can you walk back into that barn with me now? We'll do it together. I know it'll be bad. And if you just can't, then we won't, okay? But believe me when I say that the sooner you go in there, the better it'll be." She leaned back and looked at him. He nodded. "Sure? No." He smiled a little, and so did she, and her eyes grew wet all of a sudden. "I couldn't without you. I know that." "You won't have to go there without me for as long as you need." When they came to the barn, she unlatched the doors without a pause and threw them open wide. The aisle lights, so feeble in the daytime, now fanned across the snow, casting Edgar's and his mother's shadows back along the snowdrifts. Almandine trotted in ahead of them. Without stopping to think about it, Edgar walked inside and turned and pulled the doors closed, concentrating on the dimming light against the trees opposite as the doors came together. Then the three of them stood in the kennel aisle. The dogs were so quiet, he could hear his breaths and his mother's. The door to the workshop was open. Inside, the first thing he noticed was the tarnished gray milk can, tipped over, and the scrap of small bolts, nuts, hinges, nails, and washers fanned out across the floor, all coated with an orange powder or rust. He had only the vaguest memory of seeing the milk can before. His mother grasped the lip of the canister and leaned back. He helped her, and it whomped upright. They collected the scrap with their hands and dumped it into the canister. The rust left an orange stain on the gauze bandages on Edgar's palms. When they had collected all the scrap, they took out the broom and dustpan and swept and dumped the dust into the milk can, and together they wrestled the thing back under the mow steps. He thought they had swept up something unnameable and put it in that canister, and it was understood between them that they would never move it, never empty it, never touch it again. They fed and watered the dogs and cleaned the pens and tossed in fresh straw. Edgar scooped a coffee can full of quicklime from the bag by the back door and wheeled the manure down the path. After he dumped the manure, he dusted it with the quicklime. He found his mother in a whelping pen when he returned. One of the newborn pups had died, perhaps in fright from all the noise. Perhaps the mother had panicked and stepped on it. Trudy stroked it two-fingered. She and Edgar took it to the medicine room and put it in one of the thick plastic bags they kept there. Edgar took it from her and set it outside in the snow. The pup's body was still warm through the plastic, as though the mother had lain next to it even after it had died. When he came back inside, his mother was waiting for him. Her voice shook, and she put her hands on his arm so he couldn't turn away. "I want you to tell me what happened," she said. "Now, if you can, before we go back." He began to sign. He told her most of it. How he'd found his father lying there, how he'd dialed the phone and left the receiver hanging. But he didn't tell her how he'd nearly knocked himself down trying to drum a voice out of his chest. He didn't tell her about the thing that boiled and turned when he closed his eyes, or the road he'd walked down, or the rain. When he finished, she was quietly crying. They stood, arms around each other. At last, they pulled on their coats and extinguished the lights. The snow had stopped falling, but the wind rushed against the barn, whirling the dry snowflakes into frigid galaxies. The clouds hung low over the trees, the sky barricaded in gray. They crossed to the house. Almandine huffed along beside them. Behind the steamed, translucent kitchen window, Dr. Papineau appeared for a moment at the sink, then stepped out of sight. When they reached the porch, they paused to kick the snow off their boots, and they climbed the steps and walked inside. Part 2. Three Griefs. Funeral. Dr. Papineau sat at the kitchen table. Once more, the white-haired, narrow-shouldered old man Edgar had known all his life, looking as shocked and hollowed out as Edgar felt. Hard to believe such a frail figure had lifted him out of the snow by his shirt back. But then it was hard to believe almost anything that had happened that afternoon. Two pans simmered on the stove, lids clicking to release puffs of steam. Edgar shucked off his coat. His mother, resting a hand on his shoulder to steady herself, bent down to unlace her boots. Then they stood looking at one another. Papineau finally broke the silence. "It's nothing much," he said, waving a hand at the plates and bowls populating the table. "Soup and potatoes. I'm not much of a cook, but I know how to open cans and boil water." Edgar's mother crossed the room and embraced the old man. "That's fine, Paige," she said. "It's all we need tonight." Edgar pulled out a chair and sat. Almandine stepped between his knees and pressed her head against his belly and leaned in. And he set his head in his hands and inhaled the dusty scent of her mane. For a long time, the room canted around them. When he lifted his head, a bowl of soup steamed at his place, and Dr. Papineau was sliding a pan of quartered and skinned potatoes from the oven. He dished them around the table, then seated himself. Edgar looked at the food. "If you can eat, you should," Trudy signed. "Okay. It doesn't feel right to be hungry." "Are you?" "Yes. I don't know. It feels like somebody else being hungry." She looked at the bandages on his hands. "Do they hurt?" His palms jangled and his left thumb throbbed, though he couldn't remember how he'd sprained it. Facts too trivial to repeat. "Take aspirin." "I know, I will." She dipped her spoon into her soup and lifted it to her mouth and swallowed and looked back at him. He saw the resolve behind it, and out of solidarity he rolled a chunk of potato into his soup and began to break it up. Dr. Papineau cleared his throat. "I closed my office for the morning." Edgar's mother nodded. "You can sleep in the spare room. The sheets are in the bathroom. I'll make the bed after dinner."
"I'll make my own bed. Don't worry about that."
Then it was quiet, just the tick of silverware. After a while, Edgar's bowl was empty, though he couldn't have said what the soup tasted like. His mother had given up any pretense of eating.
"These things are a great shock," Dr. Papineau said. It was apropos of nothing, and there was nothing else to say. "When Rose died, I thought I was fine. Heartbroken, but okay. But those first couple of days, I didn't know what I was doing. You two need to be careful now, you hear me? I almost burned my house down that first night. I put the electric coffee pot on the stove and turned on the burner."
"It's true, Paige. Thank you for reminding us." The vet looked at Edgar, then his mother. His expression was grave.
"There's some things we should talk about tonight."
His voice trailed off. "It's okay, Paige," Edgar's mother said. "Edgar is part of everything that happens now, whether any of us like it or not. You don't have to talk around anything."
"I was going to offer to make some phone calls. Edgar will need to be out of school for a few days. I wondered if you wanted to speak to Claude and let him know what happened. And if there are other people you wanted to call, relatives or whatnot, I could help you make a list."
Edgar's mother looked at Dr. Papineau and nodded. "Yes, but I'd rather make the calls. Will the two of you clear the table?" They all pushed back from their places. Dr. Papineau put the leftovers in the refrigerator, and Edgar piled the dishes in the sink, relieved to be moving. He ran water and watched the suds grow over the plates. Dr. Papineau handed him a towel and said he was better off drying with his hands like that. Edgar's mother walked to the counter and opened the telephone book and jotted some numbers on a scrap of paper. She looked at the shattered receiver dangling on the hook, cord end up, like a broken-necked bird, then set the apparatus on the counter and dialed. She held the receiver to her face two-handed and asked if she was speaking with the principal. She said that Edgar's father had died.
"Thank you," she said. "No, I appreciate that. Yes. Thank you. Goodbye."
She lay the receiver on the counter, put both hands down, and took a breath. The speaker inside began to bleat from being off-hook, and she pressed the hook to make it stop, then dialed again.
"Claude," she said, "there's some news. I thought you should know. It's about Gar."
"Yes. He was working in the kennel this afternoon, and he had some sort of problem, an attack of some kind. No.
We don't know. Yes. Yes. Yes."
There was a long silence.
"I'm sorry, Claude. I don't feel like that would be right just now. There's nothing..."
"Yes,
Paige is here. Yes, thank goodness for him. All right. Okay, goodbye."
Then she dialed a third number and asked for Glenn, speaking in a monotone. She arranged to meet at his office the next morning, and then she was quiet, listening to Glenn talk. Edgar could only make out the moth-buzz voice from the cracked receiver, not the words. But his mother began to fold over the counter like wax softened in the sun, until her forehead almost touched the papers.
"Is that absolutely required?" she whispered. "Isn't there another..." "Yes. Yes, of course I know, but..."
More moth sounds.
"All right,"
she said. Something in the sound of her voice made Edgar's legs go weak. Dr. Papineau asked him a question. He shook his head without understanding. The vet crossed to his mother and set his hand on her shoulder. She pushed herself upright again.
"Stop now,"
Dr. Papineau said when she'd finished. He took the receiver from her hands and set it upside down on the hook.
"That's enough for one night."
She looked back at the old man, corners of her mouth tucked, eyes shining.
"Okay," she said. "That was harder than I expected."
She walked around the table to where Edgar sat and put her arms over his shoulders, letting her hands sign in front of him.
"Are you okay?"
He tried to reply and found he couldn't.
"I want you to go to sleep now."
"What about you?"
"I'm going to sit quiet for a minute."
"Go.
There's nothing else to do."
She was right, he knew. His mother was a pragmatist, maybe from years spent training the dogs. Maybe she was born that way. He squeezed her forearms until he felt her pulse beneath his fingertips, then raised a hand to Dr. Papineau in silent good night. As though agreed upon beforehand, though it wasn't, he and Trudy slept in the living room. He'd carried a blanket and pillow downstairs, and when he sat on the couch, the power to go up again and change clothes deserted him. He pulled the hem of the blanket to his shoulders and drew up his knees and closed his eyes. A ringing began in his ears, perhaps lurking there all along, but apparent only when the weight of the blanket dulled his senses. Half slumber took him. His mother and Dr. Papineau turned out the lights, and all was quiet. And then a succession of images came forward, resurrected by some crow-eyed part of his mind that would neither wake nor sleep. Fragmentary emotions possessed and released him, drawn like garments from a wardrobe and discarded one after another. Below that chaos of image and memory, something so powerfully suppressed he would barely remember it. The idea that everything once true in the world was now past, and 1,000 new possibilities had been loosed. And following that, a clap of overwhelming shame. Sometime later, he opened his eyes. His mother had drawn a blanket around her in the chair. She was tucked up into one corner. He had a faint memory of her kneeling beside him and running her hand, warm and smooth, across his forehead, palm touching his brow and ending with fingertips entwined in his hair. He hadn't opened his eyes in the moment. Her touch had released some tiny increment of the poison bound up in him that would, days to come, ripen into sorrow. And by the time he thought all this, he could no longer tell if her caress had truly happened, or whether he'd manufactured it out of necessity. The sleep that followed was black, nothing at all contained in it. Every rasp of snow against the windows roused him up on one elbow, only to have him collapse again into sleep, sawing between one world and the other. Papineau snored upstairs in the room they had once prepared for Claude. The sound penetrated the living room ceiling like the lowing of distant cattle. Moo, moo. He woke again when he sensed Amandine walking away from him. In the dark, he watched her press her nose against the blanket wrapped around his mother, scenting her as carefully as she must have scented Edgar the moment before. She stood for a time, panting softly, then returned to the center of the room. She circled and downed, and their gazes met. Her ears shifted forward. After a while, her eyes narrowed, then opened wide, then narrowed more, the liquid glint of them waxing and waning in the darkness. Finally, she sighed and slept. Come morning, his memory would be of a night spent watching over them all. And each of them, dog and boy, mother and old man, would feel the same. They walked to the barn at first light. The cold was fearsome, the sky above dilute and punctured by stars. Inside the kennel, he saw they needed more straw, and he walked through the workshop and climbed the steps to the mow and flipped on the lights. The wall of bales stood tiered like a ziggurat. It was still early in winter. Some bales still reached the rafters. A red-handled hay hook hung on a nail on the front wall. He dragged two bales to the center of the mow, lifted a hatch in the floor by a small ring, and looked down. Trudy stood below, waiting. "Go ahead," she said. He pushed the bales through and watched them fall with a half-turn and whomp against the dusty cement. He cleaned pens with a pitchfork and a wheelbarrow and dashed out fans of quicklime on the bare floors. When he cut the twine, the straw bales opened into golden sheaves. He pulled a slicker brush from his back pocket and hastily brushed the dogs. Dr. Papineau walked in while he was working, declared that he might as well look in on the pups, and disappeared through the door to the whelping room. Edgar went to his litter. Finch and Babu, the least excitable, leaned on him from opposite sides. Essay tried to climb his front. He calmed them by cupping their bellies and muzzles and asked them to sit and do other small things in lieu of real training. When they were done, Edgar and Trudy and the veterinarian walked up the driveway together. Dr. Papineau promised to call later and kept walking to his car and drove off. When Edgar came downstairs in fresh clothes, his mother was standing at the counter, broken receiver in her hands. He waited in the living room while she talked to someone at the telephone company about fixing the telephone. When she was finished, she came into the living room. "You don't have to go," she said. "I'll call Glenn and say you're not ready." "You're not going to Brenston's alone. Paige can come with me." "No." She started to reply, then nodded. Almondine stood by the kitchen door while Edgar donned his coat, then trotted down the steps and stood by the truck. It was somehow even colder inside the cab. The vinyl seats flexed like tin. Trudy put the truck in gear and navigated up the long slope of the driveway, and they drove along without conversation, listening to the crunch of ice beneath the tires. The world glowed translucent blue. Telephone poles rushed forward and fell away, wires swelling and dropping in the intervals. In Mellon, Trudy parked the truck in front of the cupolaed town hall, and the three of them followed the arrows painted on the hallway until they reached the sheriff's office. Even inside, their breath steamed. A burnt hair smell permeated the building. A white blonde girl sat at a desk wearing a winter coat and mittens. At the center of her desk, a microphone rested on a stand. She looked at them and stood and peered over the counter at Almandine.
"I'll get Glenn. You'll want to keep your coats on," she said. "Something happened to the heat. We're waiting for the repair guy from Ashland."
The girl walked to the office door behind her desk and knocked. A moment later, Glenn Papineau emerged, wearing his blue patrol jacket and hat, diminishing the room instantly. His hands, even ungloved, were like dinner plates. Edgar wondered briefly if Dr. Papineau had once been that big, then dismissed the idea. Old men got smaller as they aged, he knew, but no one could shrink that much.
"Trudy, Edgar, come on back. Sorry about the cold. Boiler problems. You don't want to know. I've been here since 6. It's a miracle we didn't burst any pipes. Coffee, either of you? Hot chocolate?"
Trudy looked at Edgar. He shook his head.
"That's okay, Glenn," she said.
"Well, bring them anyway, Annie. Maybe they'll heat the office a little. Cream and sugar in mine?"
He led them into an office somehow both spare and cluttered. Papers and notebooks mounded over his desk, but the walls were unadorned, except for a framed certificate and a photograph of a youthful Glenn in his Mellon High wrestler's uniform, pinning some unknown behemoth into a fetal curl. In the picture, Glenn was up on his toes, almost parallel to the floor, body rigid as a log, veined thighs thick as a draft horse's. The referee's arm a blur as he slapped the mat. Glenn had arranged 3 folding chairs in front of his desk, and he motioned for Trudy and Edgar to sit down, then settled himself. Almandine approached and sniffed his knee and boot.
"Hey, girl," he said.
Then, "Aha," as Annie walked in carrying 3 paper cups. With his forearm, he cleared a swath on the desk. A stack of papers plunged off the other side. He grinned wryly.
"My New Year's resolution. Every year."
"This one here is hot chocolate," Annie said.
She set the cups in the cleared space and piled the fallen papers on the desk with an expression of despair.
"Well, they're here if you want them,"
Glenn said, gesturing at the steaming cups. He made a production of opening his notebook and clicking the end of his pencil.
"Okay," he said. "What we got to do here is record what happened. That's just procedure. We want to do this fast before anyone forgets anything. I apologize about this. I know it won't be pleasant. The fact is, Pop came in this morning and gave me hell."
He paused as if suddenly embarrassed, Edgar thought, to have referred to his father as Pop.
"It's okay, Glenn," Trudy said. "Just ask whatever you need to. Edgar will sign his answer to me."
"Okay, then. Trudy, when did you go into town?"
"It was 11:30 or so when I left,"
Glenn scribbled in his notebook.
"And Edgar, you were home all day?"
He nodded.
"When did you first think something was wrong?"
Edgar signed his answer.
"He was working in the mow, and he noticed the dogs barking," his mother said. "When he came downstairs, Gar was lying on the floor."
"You were in the mow?"
"We train up there when it gets cold," Trudy said impatiently, before Edgar could reply. "You know that. You've been up there yourself."
"Yeah, I have. I'm just asking to be complete. You were up there with some dogs?"
"Yes. 2 dogs from my litter."
"The dogs that were barking were downstairs?"
"Yes."
"How long had you been in the mow?"
"An hour, maybe longer."
"You wear a watch?"
"I have a pocket watch. I didn't have it with me."
"Is there a clock in the mow?"
"Yes."
"Do you remember about what time this happened?"
"You must know that from the telephone operator," Trudy said.
"Yes, there's a record of that, but I think it would be better to get it all down as long as we're doing this."
"I wasn't paying attention.
It was after 1 o'clock, I know that.
What sorts of things were you doing with your dogs?
Come-fors, proofing stays, stay-aways. I had a hurdle set up.
Do those things make a lot of noise?
Not really.
I mean, would your father have heard you upstairs?
He would have heard the dogs running and my footsteps.
Could you have heard him downstairs?
What do you mean?
Well, if he yelled something, would you have heard him?
He would have heard a shout, Trudy said, interceding again. We call up there all the time. With the door closed, you have to try a few times. Otherwise, it's easy to hear someone.
Glenn looked at Edgar. And the door was closed?
Yes.
How about something spoken in an ordinary voice?
Not with the door closed, Trudy said. With the door open, you can hear someone talking in the workshop.
But you didn't hear a shout or anything, just the dogs.
Edgar paused. He shook his head.
Glenn made a note and turned the page over. Okay, now I'm going to ask you a hard question. But it's important you tell me as much as you can remember. You were working up in the mall with some dogs. You heard barking, you opened the door, you came downstairs. What did you see?
Edgar thought about it for a moment. I don't remember. He sighed. His mother looked at him. You don't remember?
No.
But you told me about it last night.
I mean, I know when I came downstairs I saw him lying there, but I don't remember it. I just know he was lying there. It's like I know it because someone else told me about it, not because I can see it.
She turned to the sheriff. Glenn, he doesn't remember it much, just that Gar was on the floor.
Well, that's okay. Sometimes that happens. What's the first thing you do remember?
Running to the house.
Is that when you called the operator?
Yes.
But that didn't work.
No.
Then what?
I ran back to the barn. No, wait, I ran up to the road. I thought I might see someone driving by who could talk on the phone. But there was nobody.
His mother repeated this.
This was after you went into the house?
I think so.
You don't remember for sure?
No, but I think I went back into the house.
How did the phone get broken?
He paused again.
I don't remember.
Pop says it was hanging in pieces when he got there.
Yes, I think I broke it, but I don't know when.
Okay, okay. You had them on the line and couldn't say what was wrong. Trudy, did you ever discuss with Edgar a plan for how he might call for help if he needed to?
No, not really. The assumption was that Gar or I would always be there.
The main thing we worried about was Edgar getting hurt when he was in the field or the woods. But he always had Almandine with him, and she's been watching him since he was born, so...
No.
Her eyes started to glisten, and she looked down.
We thought through so many possibilities.
As soon as we could, we taught him how to write his name, address, and telephone number in case he got lost. We were always worried about, always thinking, what if?
She tipped her face down and closed her eyes. Glenn produced a box of tissues, and she crumpled one in her hand and drew in a breath.
We worried about Edgar getting separated from us, especially when he was little. But it never happened, and he was so smart. We're talking about a kid that started reading at 3 years old. The last couple of years, it just wasn't a concern.
He knows how to handle himself with people who can't sign.
No more than just handle himself. Half his class knows how to read his sign. All his life he's been teaching people. He's good at it. Good at it. And besides, if there was ever any problem, he could just write out what he wanted to say. Nothing like this ever entered our minds.
She stopped and wrapped her arms around her sides.
Watching her do it, collect herself that way, made Edgar shudder. He could almost see her reaching inside herself to steady something, catch some falling piece of crockery.
Almandine stood and poked her nose against Trudy's hand, and she stroked the dog's back.
Oh, I'm sorry, Glenn said. He looked abashed. I didn't mean to imply you did something wrong. All I'm trying to do is get down what happened as Edgar saw it. We're going to be done here in a couple of minutes, and then we're done for good, I promise. Believe me, I wish we didn't have to talk about this, but I don't have a choice. Edgar, how you doing?
Edgar nodded. Glenn sat back and clapped his palms on his broad knees.
All right, let me ask you both a question. Had Gar mentioned anything that might indicate he was sick? A headache? Feeling tired? Anything unusual?
No, nothing, his mother said, and Edgar nodded in agreement. I thought a lot about that last night. If he wasn't feeling well, he didn't say anything.
Would he have?
Maybe not. He hated going to the doctor. He says... She paused a second and corrected herself. Said, I mean... They never fix things. They only make you feel worse.
Who's your doctor?
Jim Frost. Same as everyone else around here, I suppose.
He can fill me in on Gar's medical history?
He can. There's nothing much. The only thing that even remotely resembled a medical problem was needing glasses.
Uh-huh, okay.
This too, Glenn noted.
All right, Edgar... I'm going to ask you to tell me what you remember about your father when you went back into that barn. I want to understand if he was conscious, whether you talked to him or what.
He was awake when I came back.
Did you talk to him?
No, but he was breathing.
Could he talk?
No.
What did you think had happened?
I didn't know. He wanted to clear the scrap buckets from under the workshop stairs. When I came downstairs, he was lying in the middle of the workshop. I thought he'd hit his head, but he hadn't. I opened up his coat. I couldn't see anything wrong.
Then what happened?
Then he stopped breathing.
There was silence in the office. Glenn looked at Edgar and grunted sympathetically.
That's all?
Yes.
And then Pop showed up.
I guess...
You don't remember?
No.
What's the next thing you do remember?
Waking up in the house. Dr. Papineau talking on the telephone.
You don't remember walking back to the house?
No.
Do you remember doing anything after you went back to the barn besides being with your father?
No.
Your hands are beat up. Did that happen when the phone got smashed?
No. I was banging on the pen doors to make the dogs bark.
Why?
To make noise.
In case someone drove by.
So if an ambulance came, they would know to look in the kennel.
Right.
He wrote for a minute in his notebook.
Smart. Just so you know, the operator was still on the line when you did that. She reported hearing what sounded like dogs barking.
Just then there was a knock on the door and Annie's muffled voice.
Glenn, boiler repair is here.
Okay, he said loudly. Send them downstairs, would you? I'll be there in a few minutes.
He turned back to them.
Among my glorious duties, I supervise certain aspects of maintenance.
He grinned.
They haven't asked me to wash dishes yet, though.
He wrote something in his notes, then looked up.
Well, I know you two have a lot in your minds. There are some formalities to take care of, and then we're done. Trudy, I'd like to talk to you alone before we finish up.
She looked at Edgar.
Will you be okay waiting outside?
He nodded. He and Almandine walked into the empty foyer. From the depths of the building came the banging of hammers on pipe and the long creak of rusted threads being turned. He looked at Annie's neatly arranged desk, the microphone, the plant, the canister of pencils, the trays of forms. But when he tried to focus on anything, his gaze kept skittering away. Almandine ambled into the hallway and down to the entrance, and he followed. On the street, a truck with the words LaForge Heating and Repair, Ashland, Wisconsin, was parked behind their pickup. The day had warmed, and the street was filled with a soup of brown slush. Pale icicles dispensed a procession of water drops from the diner's eaves. He opened the truck door and climbed in beside Almandine. Dr. Frost rounded the corner. He entered the town hall through the door they'd just exited. Edgar tipped his head back and closed his eyes and pulled off his gloves so that his aching hands might go numb in the cold. His mother climbed into the truck and keyed the ignition, and they sat there while the truck idled. A semi passed on Main Street, slush flying in its wake. Further on, the little white spire of the Presbyterian Church rose against the blue sky. She put her hands on the steering wheel and straightened her elbows. "Dr. Frost," she began, then stopped and drew a shaky breath. "Tell me. It's the law that when someone dies unexpectedly, they have to do an autopsy to find out what happened. You know what an autopsy is, right?" Edgar nodded. One happened practically every night on the detective shows. His mother sighed. He could see she had been afraid she would have to explain it. "The main thing to know is that your father wasn't in pain. Dr. Frost said that it didn't hurt. What happened is, there's a place in a person's head called the Circle of Willis. It's in their brain, way down inside. Your father had an aneurysm near there. That means that one of his blood vessels was weak and it just broke. And that place where it was weak was so important that he couldn't live after that." Edgar nodded again. He didn't know what else to say. It was so definitive. There was even a name for the place where things had gone wrong. The Circle of Willis. "Dr. Frost said everyone is born with little flaws in their arteries and veins, weak spots. Most people go through their whole life and never know. The flaws aren't in places that matter, their arms, their legs. For a few people, the flaws are in bad places. And even then, those people can go their whole lives and nothing happens. But in some people, people who have a weak spot in an important place, that weak spot breaks. Sometimes they die from it. Nobody knows why it happens to some people and not others." His mother sat there and looked out the windshield. She laid her hand on Almandine's neck and smoothed her fur down, then slid her hand over to Edgar's shoulder. "Thank you for telling me," he signed. She turned and looked at him, really focused on him for the first time since they'd left the house. "I'm so sorry," she said. She didn't look like she was going to cry, only slack and exhausted and determined. "I think it's better to know what happened than not," she said. "Don't you?" "Yes." "And it doesn't mean anything like that is going to happen to you or me. We have those flaws, just like everyone, but they aren't in important places." This with an air of finality. "Yes. I have to go to Branston's now. Are you sure you want to come along?" He had told her yes, and he meant it. He wasn't scared of the funeral preparations. What scared him was sitting at home, alone,